Hello, and welcome to Four or Fewer, a subsidiary of the Brad Pitt Cast, a podcast about Brad Pitt that is currently about Lynn Ramsey. This is the final episode of the Lynn Ramsey sequence.
It's done.
Of Four or Fewer. Well, it's about to be done.
Our miniseries on Lynn Ramsey is over with this episode.
Within doing the entire filmography of Brad Pitt, we've, before then, completed the entire filmography of someone else.
It's Russian Doll style.
Which you could, if you're going to go, like, completeness over quantity, you could say, in fact, this is the Lynn Ramsey cast.
Yeah.
With a subsidiary Brad Pitt cast attached to it,
don't
which
get
is less
confusing.
Complete.
Don't get confusing, okay. Daniel. How do you feel about leaving Lynn Ramsey in your past?
Well, it feels nice to complete something. I will say that. It feels nice to be a minor completionist. It was a good journey for me because I had seen You Were Never Really Here, and that was the only film of hers I have seen. So to go back, watch her entire three-film filmography leading up to the fourth film.
With the fourth film in mind as you're going
along. Yeah, and I hadn't seen it in a few years. I should have looked up when exactly, what film festival that was. I think it was 2018.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Was a really nice way of returning to this film and seeing, like, thinking about artistic evolution as a general. Both generally and specifically in relation to Ramsey.
Evolution is an interesting thing in the context of Ramsey as well, because there are ways in which she has stayed completely the same.
Yeah.
You could put Ratcatcher and You Were Never Really Here next to each other, and you would be like, oh yeah, that makes sense as a 1-2-step evolution.
Yeah, aside from how they kind of look in terms of their, like, they're maybe slightly dated in terms of film grain or whatever, I wonder what it would look like if you reversed the, like, if you just said she made them in this order, like, what you would think of her as a filmmaker then. It wouldn't feel like, oh, she's getting less sophisticated necessarily.
No. And You Were Never Really Here kind of makes sense as a kind of magnum opus, as a debut of being like, this is everything that I'm interested in. Because it is, in some ways, her Rosetta Stone. Do I believe that? I kind of think every one of these films is her Rosetta Stone. That's what I mean. There's ways in which, you know, the filmmaker who I think about who has the most logical progression of his career is Paul Thomas Anderson, who's a filmmaker.
I still haven't seen his first film. It's on Criterion at the moment, I think.
Is it Hard Eight? Yeah, you should watch it.
They've got, like, a Gambler's series.
With California
exactly,
Split.
Exactly, which I also, my dad loves that film. I really want to watch it.
California Split is incredible. Altman, fast talking, very funny. Elliot Gould being incredible. It's so good. Anderson started with his own distinct voice, but clearly doing Scorsese. And he has a couple of films like that. And then he hits There Will Be Blood, which is just a film that changes his preoccupations entirely.
Yeah.
And then you see him experiment within that realm. So Phantom Thread is obviously indebted to the same people that There Will Be Blood is indebted to. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of stateliness to it. There's a quietness. But then
he
went into a classical mode, exactly. But then you have something like The Master, which is shot in this classical mode, but is completely
chaotic.
Wild.
Yeah.
A film that seems to be about absolutely nothing at all. I think The Master is a fascinating film.
Mm.
I was listening to someone recently say that a final scene of a film, who said this? I can't remember. A final scene of the film is the one in which you see the thesis laid bare, always.
I think I've heard that too. I don't know who said it.
No, I don't know who said it.
Write in the brandpodcast@gmail.com if you said it.
If you personally said it, send us a message. And if for that to hold in the case of The Master, then I have no idea what The Master was about. Because the final scene is Joaquin Phoenix making a woman made out of sand on a beach. Like, what the fuck is the thesis
and
his, there?
No one is sympathetic in that film, really. Maybe Amy Adams.
And it's not even really, like, a takedown of cults.
It's not particularly realist.
No, it's not meant to make you think anything substantive about cults, really, at all.
No.
And another filmmaker would definitely make it that. It would be about the insidious nature of groupthink.
Yeah.
But Anderson doesn't seem interested in anything in
I
that
guess
film.
Maybe, and you could say this about The Phantom Thread, there are questions about masculinity in there with different kinds of, like, Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman offering kind of different kinds of, I'm trying to think of a different phrase than toxic masculinity, but that kind of thing.
No, yeah, that's true.
But I know what you mean. It's broadly a nihilistic, chaotic film.
Yeah.
And Inherent Vice is just
complete chaos.
Just Pynchon.
Yeah. It's the most successful adaptation of Pynchon that is possible to imagine.
Yeah.
And your quip is that it proves why no one can ever adapt Pynchon.
Isn't he... I still... every now and then I go on a deep dive about him apparently being in that film and trying to find... Because didn't Paul Thomas Anderson say...
He's in the film somewhere. I'm sure...
It probably just means he wrote, like, his spirit or something, maybe? You think that's, I've wondered that.
I think there's a sequence in which Joaquin Phoenix walks up to a police station and there are bodies being taken out in body bags, and I wonder if Pynchon is in a body bag. That would be a very Pynchon joke. He's in the film, but he's not actually visible or recognisable. Have you seen the one photo of Pynchon that's in relatively mainstream circles?
When he's like a sailor hat and he's like smiling?
I love the sailor hat photo because it looks computer generated or something. There's a photo of Thomas Pynchon and his son.
Was it in like Manhattan? Like walking down the street, maybe?
Yeah.
I might have seen that. Oh, wow. Maybe I haven't seen that.
incredible photo of Pynchon with a moustache.
Yeah.
Dressed in God knows what. Like, dressed like a sailor or something.
There was recently that people... Did we even talk about this on the podcast? People on Twitter thought he died, and then someone realised that was just not...
It was a complete lie.
Yeah.
Twitter loves those, this reclusive author has died. Don DeLillo's death is pronounced on Twitter every other day. Yeah, astonishingly.
Mm.
The fucking social media age. You can find out erroneously that your favourite author is dead. No, Ramsey is an interesting counterpoint to Anderson, I think, because she just doesn't have these distinct phases of her career.
No. Could have been... You said earlier... Well, I was... Yeah, we were talking about... You said earlier they could all be Rosetta Stones. They could also have been made back-to-back, year-to-year. You know, they're made quite far apart, but you could imagine them being made, you know, in consecutive years.
They could also be made in literally any order.
Yeah.
Morven Callor could be her first film or her last film. You Were Never Really Here could come at literally any point you would want. What does that say? Because in some ways, I guess why I feel weird about talking like that is in some ways it sounds like the opposite of what you want from an artist. Because you want an artist to change and grow and challenge assumptions. But I think Ramsey doesn't really do that.
I think that's true. I think... Because normally it's an option between growing or getting worse, right? I think it's so rare for someone to stay static and just keep producing similarly... excellent work. I will say You Were Never Really Here is, I don't think it's far better than her other films, but it's by far my favourite.
Is it really?
And that could have to do with my experience with it, watching it at the film festival and being really blown away by it. But I feel like I do have experiences where I see a film in a cinema and love it and then watch it again later and I'm like, oh, it's not that great.
Mm.
This film just entirely stood up.
Really?
Like, no question, 5 stars.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm not, there are things in it about it that I don't like, but I think it's just so unabashedly successful.
Mm-hmm. In what it sets out to do.
Yeah, and I think the other film... Like, I had trouble with the other films. They're obviously all extraordinary works of direction. But just maybe thematically I had some disagreements or... But it's just... I think You Were Never Really Here is astonishing. I would strongly... We haven't really talked about it yet. I would strongly recommend you watch it before... listening to this podcast.
I think it's her most popular film.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's got... Probably because it's... Well, I guess Tilda Swinton's a pretty big deal.
Mm.
I wonder which has the most Goodreads... Letterboxd. What's wrong with me? Letterboxd rankings.
Goodreads sucks. Fuck Goodreads.
I broadly agree.
The interface of that website is so difficult to use.
And Amazon owns it, too. They could
clean it up. Do they really?
Yeah, they just bought... You know, they just bought MGM.
Yeah, so James Bond coming to a streaming service near you.
I guess so.
I'm sure that's what they're going to do. They've delayed James Bond like 4 times now. Surely they're just going to dump it on Amazon Prime.
Oh, boy. Also a horrible interface. The worst streaming interface.
Yeah, a terrible streaming... Tubi, the free streaming app, which is by far the best of the streaming services, has a superior interface to Amazon. Have you ever gone on to Tubi?
I don't even know what it looks like. I couldn't conjure it in my mind.
Do you want me to show you?
Yeah, please. Tubi? Let's have a live Tubi unboxing. Dan reacts to Tubi.
Tubi TV.
TubiTV.com. Not yet a sponsor. Oh, that looks like Mubi, actually, I guess. Is it related to Mubi?
No, I don't.
Oh, that's funny. It's quite nice.
Do you like it?
Reasonably elegant, yeah.
It knows that I like horror movies.
Yeah, it's got Joe's preferences down pat.
It's telling me that I might want to watch Hellmaster, the tagline of which, he'll show you the way to hell and meet you there!
I think, you know what? I think I've seen Squirm, because which is
no
because oh because it's Mystery on. Science Theater does a riff on it. It's not that scary.
I was gonna say, if you've fucking seen this obscure 70s horror film before I have, Carousel.
Oh, I love that.
2016's Carousel.
Sounds like it sounds like a one of the sub episodes within a treehouse of horror.
Yes, an all time great tagline. Step right up and die.
In exclamation all mark.
We should just have our own podcast where we just go through each of the films on Tubi.
It's alive. That is an extraordinary poster.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's like a CGI rendering.
It's alive.
It's alive! Exclamation mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could easily just watch these films.
Death Factory, Birdemic, Shock and... Oh, you know what? I think I've seen Birdemic as well because of Mystery Science Theater.
Hack-O-Lantern. These films all sound incredible. I haven't seen any of them. Swamp Head from 2011. Oh, Basket Case is great. Okay. Have you ever seen Basket
Case? No, I have not, I admit.
Do you remember when the premise of this podcast was going to be that I show you horror films that you wouldn't enjoy? I've said it before.
I wonder if we'd still be doing it.
We would not still be. There's simply no way we would still be doing it. Right? Would you?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think I would have had it for a while. I would have, each week I would have been like, I don't want to do this. It would have done some damage.
Let's end on one more good tagline. I mean, Ghostquake sounds incredible. Who knows?
H.P. Lovecraft's Lurking Fear is pretty good. Just bog in quotation marks. I really like bog.
Bog. Hey, Seed People. Night Fright.
Uninvited. 11-11-11.
These films look great,
they
Dan.
They do, actually.
Maniac, which Skinless. For some reason is from 1934 and has the cover image as a still from Un Chien Andalou.
Oh, yeah, it does too.
So I don't know what's going on there.
Yes. Yeah, Revisitant? Hoodman.
Axeman at Cutter's
New
Creek.
Roommate.
Oh, Dan, what are we doing? We're wasting our life with... I didn't come here to die.
It's pretty good.
That's a great title.
That is a good title.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are we doing dealing with Lynn Ramsey? Yeah. We should just be going through Tubi films one by one. Why were we talking about Tubi? Because you said Goodreads.
I said Goodreads, but you said it has a terrible interface. I was wondering which of Lynn Ramsey's films have the most letterboxed reviews and whether it is You Were Never Really Here.
There's no way it's anything but You Were Never Really Here.
And
life with
Kevin. Kevin's, I feel like... I mean, I feel like more people know about... I have mentioned... I feel like to multiple people, I have talked about You Were Never Really Here starring Joaquin Phoenix, and they've thought it was his I'm Not There.
I'm Not There.
Which is very funny.
Yeah.
That an artist has those two films in his filmography.
I'm Not There and You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah.
So no one's... It's,
exactly.
It's like that joke
all
about
pronouns.
All information you ever need is contained within the two books. Everything they teach you at Harvard Business College
right.
And everything they don't teach you at Harvard Business College. How many people have watched You Were Never Really Here? Whoa. 190,000 people.
That's surprising to me. What's Kevin?
There's no way it's more. Oh. It's more.
Really?
200,000.
Only just, though. It's been out for longer, 000. I guess. That's one argument.
Huh.
But I think You Were Never Really Here is much more critically loved.
Do you want to guess what the You Were Never Really Here average rating is?
3.8.
I'm doing a face. Yeah. Guess again.
3.9? Sorry.
Damn.
What's breaking the streak?
Went in the wrong direction.
Oh, okay.
It's 3.7.
I was so close.
You were so close both times.
I almost said 3. Well, I think I would have said 3.6. I think I would have gone down further.
No, 3.7.
Mm.
Which seems weird. I thought everyone loved that film. I would imagine that would be a film that would break the 4-star mark.
I guess, I think there's something that happens when you get a big star, probably with Kevin, like someone, although Joaquin Phoenix is not in normal movies, but...
No, why does Joaquin Phoenix have a cult around him? It's quite surprising.
It's astonishing to me that they had him announce Best Actor at the Oscars this year.
It's the person who won the award previously. But that was one of the astonishingly funny things about the anticlimax of this year's Oscar.
And it was Phoenix of all people.
It's not only that it was Anthony Hopkins winning and not even being present, and he offered to deliver a Zoom presentation and they turned him down, that it was Joaquin Phoenix just... The one man who hates that bullshit.
Has said he hates the Academy Awards.
Yeah, hates being part of it, hates the Hollywood machine. And yeah, you end on... you end on.
This guy who does not care. Yeah. And actively uncaring.
And the Academy Awards always have that weird kind of ending where they're like, okay, everyone, go home.
Yeah, it's like, oh, and the credits roll, the band's playing. It's always too sudden, but it was so crazy.
I'm so glad that I didn't have a horse in the race for this year's Academy Awards. I haven't had a horse in that race for a very long time. The last one was probably The Shape of Water. I really liked The Shape of Water at that time. But if I watched it again, who knows if I would feel that way.
I really liked Minari.
Get out of here.
Yeah, no, I think Minari is a great film.
A great film.
Yeah, very moving.
It's, you could watch that film 700 times over. It's been made so many times before.
Sure.
It's the oldest story in the book.
But it's a good story. So has...
Go on.
Didn't come here to die.
No one's ever told a story like I didn't come here to die before. Good pull on that name. I was trying to remember it too. Do we want to do the four sentence game on You Were Never Really Here?
Maybe.
I think you could do it in one sentence.
Okay.
I think you could do it in one sentence. I have faith in you.
An ex-military hitman who lives with his mother, who he loves, and uses a hammer to kill his victims, is commissioned to rescue a child who has been captured by a high-level pedophile ring. But when he does, it turns out it goes much deeper than he realized, and the cops take her from him, and he has to continue to pursue her and eventually rescues her. But she has killed the guy who captured him. Captured her, rather.
What a strange anticlimax this film has. In a good way, in a pointed way.
Tight 90-something minutes.
It's basically a revenge thriller in which the revenge is taken out, ostensibly. Off-screen. Yeah. You're all building up to this idea that there's a kind of pinnacle of an evil regime, and then he's just
so
dead.
Weird.
It's the film has the strangest pacing.
Yeah. When I watched it the first time, I didn't understand what I was watching.
Mm.
I left out that. Yeah,
you can achieve the one sentence.
No, because I think I got the bulk of it. But it's important that I think his mother is killed.
Yeah.
His elderly mother is killed by people who have come after him and gone to his house and found only her there.
And his mother is the reason for him staying alive. Ramsey does this great interview where she's like, this is the story of a guy who really wants to be dead, but thinks he has this responsibility to his mother. And it's the only reason that he hasn't killed himself already. Yeah. And indeed, when she dies, there's a scene in which he considers killing himself and goes about taking steps towards it, but is stopped by this revenge mission.
To save this girl.
Mm. This film is based...
I keep thinking of wonderful shots from it.
When I was thinking about this episode of the podcast, I was thinking, in some ways, this will be a difficult episode to do because there's not a huge amount of plot. And it's mostly imagistic. When I think about You Were Never Really Here, I just think about, say, four images.
Yes. I've got four images in mind, I think, that are kind of key for me.
Go on, tell me them.
Okay. The CCTV footage of him killing people in the house.
It's silent, completely silently. Yeah.
The moment where he is... I'll do them in order they appear in the film. The moment where he is lying on the floor next to the guy who he has killed. And they're both singing along to a song playing in the background. A very Ramsey-ish kind of archaic song.
Yeah.
The moment where you see the final destination of the mission where the girl is being held captive in this like governor's mansion type thing. You see it set in like a wide shot with surrounded by like greenery and like beautiful gardens, and then all of a sudden, I think maybe it cuts away and cuts back, he is standing right in the middle, like he's come from drowning himself, which is the other image, but standing in front of the mansion. The other image is when he attempts to drown himself but then sees the girl, has a vision of the girl underwater after he has buried the body of his mother in the lake.
Yeah.
And he jumps in with her. He walks into the water with her. And then, in a bit of filmmaking wizardry, you see him taking out stones from his pocket. Any other filmmaker would show him putting them into his pocket.
Mm.
And she doesn't. She just shows you removing them, which is so smart.
Yeah.
Like, that's... Because you're not sure. Like, is he going to kill himself as well? Is he, like... How is he feeling despondent? How depressed is he? How far gone is he? But you only see the moment of triumph in the kind of rejection of that, not the... Yeah. It's good.
There's some overlap between our images. My four images are... There's a sequence in which a group of tourists ask him to take a photo of them. Oh, yeah,
I've forgotten about that.
And when he is preparing to take the photo, the camera just travels over their open mouths as they're smiling, which triggers a thought in him and brings back a flashback of prior horror.
They all look like they're screaming instead of smiling.
Yeah.
Deliberately. It's really... But not like... Yeah, it's just... It's so good.
The sequence in which he's lying in bed and he's got a knife and he's slowly lowering it down to his open mouth, and then his mother causes a commotion in the bathroom and he gets up and he's like dropping the knife
in between his and moving his foot out of the way
before he stabs letting himself it in his foot,
pierce the floor.
Unbelievable.
Phoenix is maybe our greatest living actor.
Do you think?
I don't always love seeing him on screen because, like, even in The Master, like, I find him, like, I just hate that character.
Why do you hate the character in The Master?
He's so frustrating.
In what way?
I don't know.
He doesn't get his shit together?
Yeah.
He's so fake.
Sorry, that was snobbish.
It's loaded.
Yeah. But he's so, like, crude in a way that I find really... And also he's attracted to Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like, there's all these sorts of things I don't like about him.
You don't like that he's attracted to Philip Seymour Hoffman?
No.
You don't think that you would be susceptible to a cult?
Especially if it was run by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes, exactly. That's what I mean. I think there, but for the grace of God, would go the case of that movie. I always empathize deeply with Joaquin Phoenix's character's habit of making weird potions for people to drink.
That's true. That's kind of sweet, actually.
That's kind of what I do. When people come into this house, I'm like, hey, do you want to try? Dan is currently drinking a Nexbar. A raspberry, I think, is the flavor.
Out of a huge glass mug.
It's interesting that you say Joaquin Phoenix is one of the best actors, because I think I have something of a contentious relationship with him when I see him on screen. I think I see him straining for profundity slightly too much.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think he's just a little bit too showy. There's something slightly too self-reflective about him.
It's funny, because I think the way I see that is he just seems so himself. You know, in a really, like, even though he inhabits a variety, maybe that's true. He inhabits a variety. I just, I find I'm quite committed to believing in him.
This is probably the role that's most like how Joaquin Phoenix appears. Phoenix on the Oscars stage presenting the Academy Award.
Might be about to go backstage and kill someone with a hammer.
Yes, exactly. Is the character from this film.
Yeah, I think that's right.
There's something just mumbly and withdrawn about him, which is very indicative of this character. Lynn Ramsey wrote this film with Joaquin Phoenix in mind and said that there was no other actor that she could imagine. And she had his printed out photo above her desk while she was writing this film, which she wrote in 14 days and they shot in less than 30 days. They didn't have an ending when they started shooting this film.
They didn't have an ending when they shot it.
No. Well, it's just the ending of Ratcatcher.
Yeah.
That's what I mean about this idea of almost, if you were going to use a negative word for it, you'd call it stagnation. The ending of this film is identical to the ending of Ratcatcher, in that it shows you the worst possible thing that happened, and then it follows it with a kind of idyllic, dreamlike, best possible thing that happens, and completely leaves it up to you whether or not you want to believe.
Yeah.
This is, you know, it could easily be possible, spoiler alert for you, we're never really here, that this film is a film that ends with a man committing suicide in a restaurant.
Or in a lake.
Yeah, or in a lake, absolutely. Yeah. And that the rest of the film is just wish fulfillment dreams about how good life could have turned out if he hadn't killed himself. It's a wonderful lifestyle. Yeah, so why is it not bad that she just repeats herself? I guess that's what I'm haunted by. Why is Lynn Ramsey is a very exciting filmmaker to me, but she basically made one movie split up into four parts, I think I've decided.
Well, it's
is that not a problem?
I read the Wikipedia plot summary of the Stephen King novel she's currently adapting or about to adapt, and it's so Lynn. It's as if she wrote the novel.
Yeah.
It has so many of her themes. Have you read the book?
Yeah. Childhood, innocence, trauma.
Lostness. Yeah.
Water.
Yeah. It's crazy. No wonder she was keen to direct it. So many writers creative people, artists, have a relatively small scope of... Like, their arsenal is relatively small. Like, people really just plumb the same depths again and again. I don't think it's that uncommon. I think it's just pleasing to see someone who does it with such enthusiasm. Like, unashamed enthusiasm. She's, like, she's not pretending she's doing something else.
Mm.
I think that's really relieving. Because you see, you know, I'm trying to think of an example. I think so many artists will try to, like, cover their tracks, or, like, cover their influences, or pretend that, you know, they're telling a different story, but you can kind of see the same themes running through it. But she's just absolutely happy to be, like, looking at these different narratives and finding the particular thing she's interested within them, and is very good at it. Oh, the, yeah, there's a few... Yeah, I just remembered another image that really sticks in my mind that I remember being, like, blown away by when I saw it in the cinema, which is the title card occurs when Joaquin Phoenix is in a cab, and there's, like, Johnny Greenwood's impeccable soundtrack, which is
unbelievable. So it's the best soundtrack he's ever done. It's one of the best soundtracks.
Which is a good... Like, for Johnny Greenwood, that's saying something.
Yeah, the There Will Be Blood soundtrack is also extraordinary. The Phantom Thread soundtrack is extraordinary, but this is something else.
As the title of the film flashes on the screen, the cab driver's lips move to mouth the title.
Yeah.
And it just is a close-up on his mouth. So he's, like, singing along, or maybe talking into a phone, or maybe talking to Joaquin. It's not really clear. But, the like, this thrumming, whatever, Johnny Greenwood instrument is playing over it. And you see him mouthing, "You were never really here."
Yeah, it's extraordinary. What makes the soundtrack so good is there's that... One of my favorite bits of the soundtrack is there's, like, a guitar noodling part, a part that's, like, and there's, like, ramshackle drums coming in.
Yeah.
And it sounds almost like a parody of revenge thriller music. Like, there's the forward momentum, there's the kind of sense of scale and scope, but it's done in this lopsided, extremely massive chaotic way.
Yeah,
there's a real sense in which... This is like if you were having a stroke and you were watching Liam Neeson's Taken. This is what this film looks like.
Yeah, there's also something that's coming to mind for some reason, are the scenes, which are very prominent in the film, but never really. She does a lot of underhanded gesturing towards things, that just exquisite storytelling, like these minor flashbacks, which almost aren't, but almost feel like flashbacks to Ratcatcher.
Yeah.
You know, like this childhood of, like, either, you know... maybe abuse, maybe, like, some kind of his parents fighting. But, like, maybe cumulatively 30 seconds in the film. Maybe not even that. But he puts plastic bags over his face and, like, hyperventilates into them. As if, like, maybe not quite committing suicide, but, yeah.
Yeah, a form of...
Oblivion.
A form of oblivion, absolutely.
And then you see him flashing back to him as a child doing that.
While his parents are screaming and fighting with one another. Yeah, I think the major thing to say about this film, and what I think is the most extraordinary thing about this film, is Ramsey has done this kind of stuff before, but this is the first time she's pushed it to this extent. This is a subjective experience of a film, the likes of which I don't know how many filmmakers have tried so closely to follow the thought patterns of their main characters.
Yeah.
Because you say that these flashbacks are very brief. They're brief, I think, because they're designed to resemble intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
We see his face. We see this very, like, it's done. I mean, the major one is he gives a candy bar to two children while he's stationed as a soldier. And then one child shoots the other.
And takes the candy bar.
And you see it happen so quickly. There's no dwelling whatsoever. It's basically one shot per kernel of information.
And that's also, like I said, he was ex-military, but that's the only reason you know it. You know he was deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan just, again, probably less than 30 seconds cumulatively. You see in the lead up to that the kind of a foot of a corpse in the sand, probably a child.
Kicking out as the person is dying.
A couple times. Yeah, that's right. Not quite a corpse, but in pain, obviously. And... you see that a couple of times, you're not sure what it refers to. You get the, like, 4 seconds of... You don't even see... Joaquin's not in the scene. You just see, because you know it's his memory, you see the hand the candy bar through, like, a chain-link fence. The gunshot, that's it. That's really, like, exquisite. Just such a good film about trauma.
Such a good film about trauma. And also, it's an overused word in our culture, but also a film about being triggered.
Yeah.
I think so much of this film, because of its subjective framework, operates under the basis of associative thinking. So the one that I spoke about before, when he's asked to take this photo of this group of tourists, there's just something about their faces that reminds him of being... You assume that he's been working in some kind of, like, FBI agency or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's never sketched out really at all. And he opens up a container of dead bodies.
Oh, that's right.
Then that's what they remind him of.
Like,
they felt
like immigrants who may be, like, people brought as asylum seekers in the back of a truck but died in the truck, or, like, oh, were murdered and put there. Like, it's really... That's right, I'd forgotten about that flashback.
It's the basis of the second season of The Wire. Have you watched
that's
The Wire?
That's right, yeah.
The Wire is also about a shipping container of presumably child brides.
Yeah.
In which they're all killed because the container is put such that there's not oxygen properly coming in. And that's, I think, what's meant to be going on here. It would be really interesting. This film is based on a book by Jonathan Ames.
Of all people.
Which is so
behind
weird.
Bored to Death. Sorry, yeah. Jason Schwartzman.
Ames is the creator. He's also the person that the song Jonathan by Fiona Apple is written about. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. A weird PTA connection.
Yeah, true. I hadn't even thought of that. Mm. Yeah, Ames dated Fiona Apple for some time.
That's very weird.
There's a really good New Yorker profile about Fiona Apple in which... It talks about the fact that she still sees Ames. He regularly comes over to her house, and they bicker and squabble throughout the entire profile because he keeps telling her that she's got this chronic pain, and he keeps saying, "Oh, you need to go to therapy. You need to go to therapy." And she's going like, "Shut the fuck up."
That's funny. And he seems like kind of a sweet guy.
Yeah,
I quite like Bored to Death. It's a little like self-indulgent.
I never saw it. It looked like Wes Anderson light.
Yeah, but Ted Danson's very a real pleasure. And Jason Schwartzman is funny. It's not great, but it's super watchable. And Zach Galifianakis is fun. It's just fun. Like, it's a good... It's a watchable... It's one of those things where, like, if you haven't seen it and you're looking for something light to watch, it's totally worthwhile.
Actors making failed...
It's very funny.
...prestige projects is incredible. You know that Ewan McGregor directed an adaptation of Philip Roth's American Pastoral?
Oh, you know what? I didn't know... McGregor directed that. I knew he was in it.
Yeah, that's a Ewan McGregor joint.
That's very funny.
Yeah, just the worst kind of vanity project. Mm. Although we'll be talking about the best kind of vanity project very soon, because, of course, the best vanity project ever made is Angelina Jolie Pitt's By the
Sea.
Which
I haven't seen.
It will be weird to force ourselves back into the Brad Pitt mold.
It will be, actually.
We'll have to talk about
the strange time.
Spate of Brad Pitt news that's coming out. Should we do that later on this episode? How prepared are you for this conversation?
Not in the four or fewer.
Okay.
I think this is its own little universe.
We keep it hygienic.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a film that follows the logic of a disordered mind.
Yeah, but and in doing so, never feels disordered as a film.
No.
I guess that's what I want to say. Like, it doesn't feel like it's a mess. Even if sometimes you don't understand what's going on, it never feels like the film hasn't given you enough information, which is pretty extraordinary given how little information the film does give you. I think I'm obsessed with how effective the storytelling is in this film. I think that's what makes me like it so much.
Really? That it's just so lean?
Yeah, like the kid, like it's like just little things like the kid from the convenience store that is his contact for getting money for the hits that he does, sees where he lives, and he has a conversation with that about the convenience store owner, and so like dumps the convenience store as a contact, but you know that that is how the bad guys found out where he lives. And you see, like, a shot of the convenience store owner and the kid, possibly his son, I think, being held at gunpoint. You're not really sure by who. Just that all the information you don't need is cut out, and all the information you do need is included in such, like, a scalpel-like manner.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
And I think it follows lessons from Bresson, who's a filmmaker that Ramsey has often talked about being an influence. Bresson is really interesting because, and I think it's, you're talking about it in terms of the stones in the pockets.
Mm.
Bresson is famous for showing you things that you would really, really, really think were essential scenes. So have you ever seen Pickpocket?
No.
Pickpocket is this film about a pickpocket. It's actually very You Were Never Really Here. It's extremely stripped back character study. It's also famously very Taxi Driver. Paul Schrader took a lot from Pickpocket to make Taxi Driver. And it's about this guy who lives a life of crime, who falls in love with a young woman, and it's basically a romance movie. And there's a sequence early on, you've been introduced to him as a pickpocket. He goes to this fair to go and pick people's pockets. You see him in wide shot walking into the fair, and then you just cut to him being arrested. There's no sequence in which he's trying to pick someone's pocket and he gets spotted. There's no, it's just completely cut out. You're just like, okay, he's arrested now. And that similar bravery of going, a sequence that would otherwise be essential is just removed, is all throughout You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah.
I think if you pitch this film and you say to someone, hey, I want to make a revenge film, everyone just assumes that we're going to see the revenge take place. Yeah.
And also, it's there are moments of... The most significant moment of violence is when you see Hank from Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. Is that
yeah.
the guy? Who is the
kind the of sex boss. GIF guy? Do you know about that?
I don't think so.
He just once tweeted out sex GIFs.
Oh, yeah.
Dean Norris is That's the right. actor's
Good
name.
Stuff. Very, sweet. He has been killed quite brutally, and you see his, like, Joaquin Phoenix discovers his body when everything is falling apart, like in between him rescuing the girl, losing her, and before he gets her back. But you don't, like, even you say this is a film about a guy who kills his hits with a hammer, often it's seen kind of at a distance. Even like the sound design's a bit awful, but like it's not that
by awful you just mean unpleasant
yeah.
to sit through.
Sorry, yes, thank you. Awful for me. But there's not that much... often, the CCTV often, like, cuts kind of fragmentedly.
But this is what I mean about...
It's not that brutal, but it feels brutal.
This is what I mean about stagnation. That's what she did in We Need to Talk yeah. About Kevin. It's the same thing again.
Exactly the same.
The approach to violence is precisely the same. You almost always see the aftermath of violence. You actually see very little violence.
It's really hard to remember whether both of these are violent films.
Yeah, exactly. They feel kind of, in your memory, they feel much more violent than they actually yeah. are. It's the Psycho effect. Alfred Hitchcock yeah. always talked about the fact that there's barely any stabbing in the shower scene of Psycho. It's just all complete association. And similarly here, yeah, there were probably... 14, 15 shots of actual violence over the course of this 90-minute film. And yeah, so many of the times you only see the aftermath. Obviously, in the finale, all you see is the aftermath of violence.
Yeah.
But also, you never see his mother get shot. You never see Hank from Breaking Bad get tortured.
Yeah.
You're just always seeing these remnants that need to be cleaned up. I think we should talk about one of the very important films that...
Oh, yeah.
...is deeply indebted to You Were Never Really Here. I think we need to talk about Todd Phillips's 2019? 2020?
On the cusp. I think 2019. I remember when I was in New York, there were posters everywhere for it. But I think they were, like, for your consideration posters. I think it was 2019.
We need to talk about Joker.
Yeah.
Because Joker is a Lynn Ramsey film. It's extraordinary sure. to think how much it just is a Lynn Ramsey film.
Yeah.
If Lynn Ramsey followed up You Were Never Really Here with Joker, it would make perfect sense.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It's not as good as a Lynn Ramsey film.
I think it's pretty good.
I don't love Joker.
What are your problems with Joker?
It is disrespectful to King of Comedy, one of my favourite films.
It's not disrespectful
I think it
to
is.
It. In what way?
I don't know. It just uses it, but without any of its sensitivity. Any sensitivity to the source material. It doesn't understand what makes the source material so good. It like, cribs it unintelligently, I think. But I just didn't enjoy it. I just didn't have a good time while I was watching it.
Because it's too mean?
It's definitely mean, but it also, like, I think it's worth remembering that Todd Phillips made The Hangover, right?
Mean,
which
very
is a mean.
Mean
film, and like is not a film about anything good in the world.
No, Todd Phillips is one of cinema's, and I say this in a way that is designed to mean praise, one of cinema's most black-hearted directors.
Yeah.
He's got an evil sensibility.
Yeah, which I think I am averse to that.
I love it so much. It's astonishing that someone, don't you think, whether or not you enjoy the experience of watching the films,
sure.
it's astonishing that the director of one of the most successful comedies of all time hates people.
Yeah, it's very funny.
It's just an astonishing fact. And the fact that he then went to superhero movies and he was like, you know what, I'm going to shake up the superhero genre by making a movie that hates people.
Which I respect, right? Because he didn't take that much money. Or, like, it was a small budget film. They kind of changed superhero movies in some sense.
Hopefully for the better.
Yeah.
I think the idea that Phillips demonstrated to Hollywood was that if we're going to make superhero movies, don't try and create this, you know, globe-spanning, multi-film-spanning universe. Just do something fun, because that's the only way to avoid superhero fatigue, is to take a bunch of money and be like, hey, we're going to make a Martin Scorsese film starring the Joker. Or, you know, I think the next Joker film, they're already talking about a Joker sequel, and I think the next one should be set in, like, the Shogun era, and Joker should be a samurai. Just do it, send Joker to space. That's the approach. And that's one of the things that I found Exactly. That's one of the things that I found so thrilling about Joker, is how small it is in scope. Admittedly, it does have to show you the murder of fucking Thomas and Martha Wayne again.
Every, like, seventh time. I think its politics are better than, like, the Avengers. It's not individualist, it's communal.
Yeah.
And it's about the failure of the welfare state.
Yeah, it's about class. Joker is just a film about class.
I appreciate that. I really do, especially in the superhero genre. I think it's too self-serious for me. And I know it's funny to say that on a You Were Never Really Here episode, but You Never Really Here is like, kind of, like, the scene in the diner is funny, right? So we haven't really unpacked it, but he rescues the girl. It turns out the girl slit the throat of her captor, and is like, he comes across her in this mansion. One of the greatest lines in 21st century cinema, she says, I think, we don't even know if you've said his name is Joe, she says, it's okay, Joe, right? Or it'll be all right, or something like that. Like, she's comforting him. So smart. Like, could not, there's no possible better line for that moment. They go to a diner together, and then she goes to the bathroom or something, and he shoots himself. And after he shot himself, the blood splatters everywhere and no one notices. Everyone's just, like, walking by. And then it cuts and he's just asleep. Or, like, he has his head on the... like, his head where he was when he shot himself, but in fact he hasn't shot himself. The girl returns and is like, you know, let's go somewhere.
It's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day, as quoting Frances McDormand in Fargo.
Mm-hmm. Your favourite line.
Yeah. There is some humor spun out. There's some humor when Joaquin Phoenix is singing on the floor with the guy he's killed. Like, there's some, like, lightness or, like, fascination with the world. The surreality is really interesting. I just don't think Joker has any of that intelligence. It's not, for a film about a comedian, it's not very funny.
I know.
know that's the point.
I know what you're going to say about this. And I know it's loaded with problematic assumptions.
Yeah.
But I think there's a similar surreality and weird approach when he kills the clowns that he's worked with.
Oh, yeah.
And the clown, who is a little person, can't reach the doorknob to get out after he's killed his friend. And he lets him go. Yeah. And obviously that scene is deeply problematic. There's something cruel. It's like making jokes about a disability. But
murder is also deeply problematic. We're already in problematic territory.
But there is at least, even though I don't think the scene is entirely successful, there is at least a sense of taking time to submerge oneself in the universe that one has created in that sequence.
Yeah.
And that's what I think when you're talking about, when you talk about these funny moments. They're like moments of pause and reflection in which the audience can suddenly go, oh, what I'm looking at is deeply strange or deeply funny. It's a moment where you're kind of given the permission to relax slightly out of the film. And I think Joker has those moments too.
They
and
just
I think
feel
controlled.
They feel more like frat guys came up with them in Joker.
He is a frat guy though. Yeah. Todd Phillips is frat guy.
I think Lynn Ramsey is someone who understands how to find beauty in the darkest places. That sounds so corny.
No, like, that's a modus operandi.
To beauty in the world. And there are those really like finding triumph in the worst possible places in your life, which she manages to earn. I think You Were Never Really Here, through all its kind of implied and real violence, finds these moments of beauty that make the violence kind of necessary. And I think Joker takes the opposite turn, which is toward nihilism, and that's just hard for me to enjoy or appreciate or like even engage with.
I love nihilism. So we're just talking about a difference in... chalk it up to a difference in taste in some ways.
I think nihilism can be done well. But I don't know...
What's the most nihilistic film that you like?
It's a very good question. I'm just trying to think, because I'm shuffling through, like... I think High Life has a very hopeful ending. And it's like the nihilism of the Coen brothers kind of turns me off as well. I mean, yeah. Burn After Reading might be up there, because I'd say that's a nihilistic film that I really enjoy, mm-hmm. but I still have some problems with it.
The Swimmer? Do you think The Swimmer is nihilistic?
I think it's a... No, because I think... But it's Burt Reynolds, right?
No. Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster, obviously. Sorry, I always get them confused.
Burt Lancaster, greatest living... Or no longer living, but yeah. One of the greatest all-time screen actors.
He is showing you how not to live your life.
Mm.
I think there's this kind of... And none of that, right? Like, none of that... I mean, I don't know exactly where it is, but, like, that kind of upstate New York Hamptons-ish lifestyle, whatever is being portrayed, is... It's not appealing, and it's kind of... It's a critique of something that is... And in its critique, it's kind of hopeful, I think, or productive. The ending, I guess you could say, is nihilistic, but spoiler alert for The Swimmer. Really skip this if you haven't seen The Swimmer. The ending is like, well, his family's gone somewhere else, right? Like, they've managed to get on without him.
And so it's hopeful for them, if not so. For him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The Joker is just, like, chaos for everyone.
Yeah. The Joker is...
Almost literally.
The Joker is about the divide, I think, between the personal and the political. Mm-hmm. There is a political movement going on of chaos and anarchy, and the Joker has personal love of chaos and anarchy. And there's a kind of sardonic joke in the fact that the Joker becomes... the spokesperson for a rage that is political in nature, where for him it's completely without a focus point.
Yeah, which is especially interesting because he is given political motivations, but they don't really matter.
No.
Like, he's the state kind of... I mean, the Joker wouldn't have happened if the state was doing its job.
No.
But at the same time, he's not like...
railing, you know, against the state.
Rise up and... No. Yeah.
He's a product of inequality that doesn't seem particularly alive or interested to the problem of inequality. Yeah. There's a version...
Not as a political problem.
There's a version out there where the Joker becomes, a, you know, yeah. I don't know, a social worker. Social worker with a heart of gold. A podcaster. Spreading the message of social joy. I'm going to pause just because my computer's on the blink and I'm going to save...
I love that. So we don't lose
52 minutes of material. And I'm leaving this...
We'll probably play in the break.
Yeah, imagine if we had ads. Maybe we could do Tubi. A fake ad. Tubi. You too have a taste for... I mean, everyone's made this joke, right? But it's extraordinary when you're listening to a really heavy podcast about something really heavy. And they just have the pivot.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was found dead with 12 axe wounds in her back.
Mattresses.
Don't you hate having to prepare food for yourself every night? Who would sponsor us? Surely someone would sponsor. I keep thinking that Mubi should sponsor us, but maybe now the way we get the Mubi sponsorship is by getting in with Tubi.
Yeah, Tubi, jealous.
Tubi have no money. So
I mean, but they're not even subscriptions, so they couldn't even give us free subscriptions.
No, they couldn't give us anything for free. Unless they have, you know, the original celluloid print of I Didn't Come Here to Die.
We have to watch that film.
We do have to watch that film. In the Letterboxd game, let's do Letterboxd reviews of You Were Never Really Here and Letterboxd reviews of I Didn't
Come Here to
Die. Coming up on the Brad Pitt. I'm going to pause, save, and Jan brought some shortbread. I think I might grab a slice of shortbread. I'm going to say something that's related to a conversation we just had. I won't reveal the conversation we just had off mic. Do you know the Dan Byrne song Jerusalem?
No.
I think you would really like it. It's Bob Dylan pastiche.
Oh, yeah.
Told from the point of view of a character who thinks that he's Jesus Christ. And there's just a line which goes, I know how I hate to wait. And whenever I have to wait for anything, I always have Dan Byrne's voice in my head saying, I know how I hate to wait.
I love things like that just kind of like stick there.
Yeah. Little, how do you pronounce it? Mnemonics.
Mnemonic, yeah.
I'm also going to have... I know some people hate eating on mic, but Dan's brought some delicious shortbread.
I'm glad you're enjoying it. It's my mother's recipe, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to say that about something.
No, this is. Yeah, it's Scottish originally, apparently.
Hmm. Do you have any final words on You Were Never Really Here? And then let's rank the Lynn Ramsey films, and let's do Letterboxd.
It's not like... Something I find myself thinking of quite a lot lately, which is Susie Kreh's... film criteria system by which you rank how enjoyable a film is and its quality, and can like consider both together. It's pretty good on both. It's not a film that I don't totally share its vision of the world. I'm not totally in love with its philosophy or kind of portrayal of the world.
Because you think it's too cruel?
Yeah, too, just some. I mean, I don't quite want to simplify it to that, but something like that. Like, if the things it's interested in, like the kind of cartoonishness, say, of the pedophile ring, or like these insane, like it's really not a big deal. Like, these are things that, for me, aren't huge deal breakers for the film by any means, but things that I find, like, a little bit tiresome or cliched or whatever. But they just fade in comparison to how well executed this film is.
Mm.
It's totally a 5-star film for me. Like, I just think it's... Really? I don't... If someone was like, what are your favourite films? I'm not even sure I'd list this, but I just enjoy... I don't want to say I had such a good time watching it, but I was so...
Awed.
I was awed by it. Like, as an artistic... As a work of art, I think it's really impressive. Mm. And it shows how... Because I think you could read... There is the way in which any of her films are a Rosetta Stone, but I think the point is that they're a Rosetta Stone for her other films. It's important that they exist in relation to one another.
Yeah.
And I think... Like, I was looking at reviews, and this was pretty well reviewed, but there were a couple of people who thought it was trash. Incorrectly. Obviously. And I think you could just look at this film by itself, and you would be mistaken, but kind of think of it as kind of messy or incomplete. But when you see how consistent her vision is... It really shows that this is someone doing what they set out to do.
Mm.
And I think her career is testimony to that. And it's very impressive. It's very rare. It's why she's only made 4 films despite a reasonably lengthy career. Because she has a vision and she executes on it. And that's a really impressive thing to do in this era of filmmaking. Or just any like creation at all.
Mm. I think that's definitely true. I think she stands alone as a filmmaker. In a way that some of the other filmmakers that we'll presumably talk about in 4 or fewer don't even. Because, like, uniqueness is a path to greatness, but it's only one path to greatness. And there are lots of filmmakers who don't stand alone but make extraordinary films. Like, someone like Ari Aster is so indebted to a whole bunch of very obvious influences. There's just a kind of magic to the way he combines those influences. Whereas Ramsey doesn't seem obviously influenced by anyone.
And obvious... It's funny, like, I think about... Aster seems... There are certain filmmakers, I think PTA is one of them, maybe this is an ignorant thing to say, and you'll correct me if it is, but who really seem like film lovers, and they're like doing film. Ramsey, I'm sure, has watched a million films and is obsessed with cinema, but her film isn't like, I love film and I'm going to like do all these fascinating... Even though she's like, the worlds she convey depend on their filmicness, she's not someone who kind of wears her influences on her sleeve or is particularly concerned with, like, showing them off.
No. She doesn't seem interested in, quote-unquote, cinema particularly.
No, exactly.
I think it's worth noting that 3 out of 4 of her films are adaptations of novels.
Yeah.
I think she's interested in storytelling as it is in literary fiction, and I think she's something of a painter, which is maybe a pretentious thing to say.
No, I think that's... Yeah.
She's interested in single, discrete images, and each of her films... If I think about Ratcatcher... I think about the mouse going to the moon.
Yeah.
If I think about Morven Keller, I think about Morven standing in the river showing her lingerie to the fisherman.
Yeah.
If I think about We Need to Talk About Kevin, I'm thinking about Tilda Swinton covered in tomatoes.
Sure.
And if I think about You Were Never Really Here, I'm thinking about Joaquin Phoenix submerged in water. And plot, thematic stuff, character stuff, all come secondary to those images. Yeah. She's first and foremost an imagistic filmmaker.
And always submersion in... Submersion? Immersion? Something. There's always people being dunked in water. Every single film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure there will be in her next one as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is in the book, so...
It would very make a funny. Lot of sense. I wonder if she's like, this is for me. Only taking...
I wonder if she had some water submersion in Jane Got a Gun. Maybe that's why she walked off the set of that film. She was like, listen, I've got to have someone get submerged in a large body of water. Time to rank the films of Lynn Ramsey. Would you like to go first?
I mean, so hard, because they're each so distinctive, despite being like... but from 4 to 1, I'm going to say Ratcatcher, Kevin, Morven Keller, You Were Never Really Here.
You liked We Need to Talk About Kevin more than Ratcatcher?
Maybe not.
No, you can stand by your assumptions.
I think so. I think I was just... That film stuck with me more.
Huh.
Maybe it's that we had that insane dog like yelping all the way through Ratcatcher. Yeah, I liked Ratcatcher. These are 4 great films.
Yeah, that's the proviso that I give it.
And I know I complained about Kevin a lot. And I still hold that. Like, I still commit to that. Like, it's not a film I want to watch again. I think I'm most likely to want to watch Morven Keller and You Were Never Really Here Again.
Mm-hmm. Should I do my fourth?
Ratcatcher's just so bleak.
Ratcatcher's very bleak.
Like, it's just not... Like, at least Kevin is... Yeah, I don't know. That's pretty bleak too, but not in a different way.
I think Kevin ultimately is uplifting.
Yeah.
I agree with the reading that we did from The Father the other day, that it's a film about finding authenticity.
I think that's fair.
And Ratcatcher doesn't really hold anything like that.
No. Just a much, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way at all. It's a much smaller film, I guess.
Ratcatcher?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You've got to make small films, but it doesn't stick with me as much.
My four are... Fourth, we need to talk about Kevin.
Mm.
Third, Ratcatcher. Second, You Were Never Really Here. First, Morven Keller. I just think Morven Keller is where it's at. I think that's such a great film. Talk about images that stick with me. Like, there's so much of Morven Keller that's just permanently etched in my brain.
Sure.
The sequence at the end where she's at the club is just...
Yeah, that is... I gotta listen to that song again.
Yeah, Dedicated to the One I Love by the Mamas and the Papas.
It's good.
Just so good. I'm sad to be leaving behind
Lynn Ramsey. Me too. Make more films, Lynn. Make that Moby Dick in Space epic.
Absolutely opera. Make that.
Yeah.
And if we're still doing the podcast when your next film comes out, we'll cover it.
Definitely.
We'll do a special episode.
Yeah, hopefully that's not... You can imagine with her just being a decade away.
Yeah.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully nothing falls through in the interim. Do we know who the next four off your filmmaker we're doing
is? I think so. I feel like I should have written this down. I feel like I encountered a filmmaker the other day and I was like, oh, why haven't we mentioned that person? But no, I don't remember who it was.
We did tentatively suggest it would be John O'Glazer.
Yeah, which would be great. Was he three?
Is he three? Yeah.
That's crazy.
Is that true? Sexy Beast. Birth. Under the Skin.
Is that all? And he is making another film about the Holocaust.
He's making another film about the Holocaust.
Hopefully we get through this before that comes out.
You don't want to watch a film about the Holocaust?
Not by Jonathan Glazer. I mean, I do, but, you know, just in the right conditions. I have to work up to it. I guess that's what Four or Fewer is for.
Exactly. To prepare you.
Well, I've seen two of those three films. Mm. Birth, maybe we've already got an episode recorded on it that we've never released. Our very first test episode.
We could just drop that one. It must be terrible. It must be so bad. I hope we've gotten better. It would be really sad if we listened to that episode and we were like, oh, that one's kind of good. Although the Ad Astra episode is terrible, so I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
It's not that bad. We just go on for far too long about things that don't matter.
That's funny. We must have been looking to fill time.
We must have been panicking about filling time. Because we just basically do the plot of Ad Astra from beginning to end.
I think that was my idea. I was like, well, if people haven't seen the film, they'll want the plot.
It's like an hour of us going, and then Brad Pitt does this, and then Brad Pitt does... It's
very funny.
I've
got so many listens that episode.
I know. Don't even think about it. Alright, let's do Letterboxd Game.
I Didn't Come Here to Die, right? That's what we're looking for as well.
Should we do that one first?
Yeah, let's do it first. Because we should end on You Were Never Really Here. My guess.
Go on. Average rating for I Didn't Come Here to Die. 3.1.
Is that high?
That's really high.
Okay, I don't know Letterboxd that well, I guess. But, yeah, I'm going to stick with that. Because I feel like if you're watching that film, surely you're committed to it. No? 2.6?
2.6!
Yeah. Back on the wagon.
How do you do it?
I don't know.
It's freaky. It's always the second guess.
That time I feel
guess.
Like you were more... Your face was more just like, no, it's lower.
But there's a lot of...
A lot of numbers.
There's
50.
A lot of numbers between lower and zero. Wow, what the fuck? It kind of freaks me out, I'm going to be honest.
I've always been pretty good at estimating. I feel like I
but
do this...
But based on one what?
Of my...
You don't... You, that's not estimation. It must be blind chance. I refuse
Maybe I'm
a
psychic.
I refuse to let you call that estimation. You know nothing about this film. You know nothing about Letterboxd.
My friend and I used to have a game... Where, Will, actually, Susie's... Not sister, brother. Susie Gray's brother, Will, who's a listener as well, I believe. Used to have a game where so every now and then we still indulge in it where we're like a big Pitchfork review will be coming out and we would like guess what it was, and I think sometimes I will look at their like because on the homepage like their description of the album and be like I bet it's just from
see,
like
see that's estimation this was
no
not estimation
yeah.
Do you want me to read you the plot synopsis on Letterboxd for I Didn't Come Here to Die? The tagline is volunteer work can be a killer. The story of six young volunteers working on a humanitarian project in the woods. Horrific accidents, rash decisions, and the unpredictability of human nature leads them all to the same disturbing conclusion. That sounds kind of interesting.
Sounds like a not quite. What's it? What are the word? What Final Destination?
Yeah, the director Bradley Scott Sullivan
mm-hmm.
has made one film.
Wow, four or fewer.
And it's I didn't come. Dan, don't tempt me. It stars a bunch of people I don't know. Oh, maybe we have to do it. Tell me how many people have watched this film.
Watched it. Yeah. I mean, this. I feel like we can't bring out our power too much. Right? No. I also have just no sense of what Letterboxd... So this is how many people have rated it.
Yeah.
1,800?
You're way off.
So more or less? Like
way fewer.
Oh, like 180.
10%. You've undershot.
360?
You've overshot.
280.
You're very close. 269.
Yeah.
It's only 269. There's only 49 reviews. Do you want me to try and find you a highest possible review?
Yeah. Is there any 5 stars?
There's a single 5-star.
Who is this person? Can we get them to guest on the episode?
Justin. Justin's display picture is a image from the video game Dead Space. Have you ever played that video game?
Yeah, I have actually.
I really like Dead Space. Justin's top 4 films are Alien.
Sure.
Aliens.
Yeah.
Alien much better than Aliens, do you think?
I haven't seen either, still.
What the fuck, yeah, Daniel? I know. You have to go and see Alien. Will you watch it tonight?
Possibly. Tonight, yeah, maybe. I got some stuff to do. I'll commit to watching it within a couple of weeks. How about that?
Okay, that sounds good. Alien 3.
Is that the Whedon one?
The
Fincher.
The Fincher directed Alien 3. Alien Resurrection.
Okay.
That's the Whedon one.
Okay.
So their top 4 films are...
Well, the Alien.
The Alien quadrilogy.
Not Prometheus.
No. No, thank you. Justin's review. Mega low budget black comedy. This was awesome. And the chainsaw scene was probably one of my favorite scenes I've watched lately. This film sounds good.
For you, certainly.
Chainsaw scene. Maybe I'll convince my roommate to watch it with me this evening. And then, do you want a 5-star?
Yeah, please. I just like thinking of I Didn't Come Here to Die being said with different cadences. I didn't come here to die.
I didn't come here to die.
Different emphases. I didn't come here to die.
I didn't.
Why? Me?
I tell you something about me. I didn't come here to die. Paddy Feehan. Top 4 films. John Carpenter's The Thing.
I haven't seen it.
You fucking haven't seen The Thing?
I know. I haven't. It feels so upset. Like,
it's not gruesome. That upsetting. Okay. It's really not.
I once made a good joke about it, which I've talked about on the podcast.
You have, about a year and a half ago, which is around the time that I gave you fucking The Thing on Blu-ray. Sorry. Didn't I give you Alien on Blu-ray as well?
Yeah, and I still haven't watched that either.
Didn't I give you Silence of the Lambs on Blu-ray?
Yeah. And I am very bad at watching movies. I will watch them all.
If nothing else comes up, watch one of those 3 films this evening.
Okay. Alright.
Do you promise me?
If nothing else comes up, yes, I promise.
Only if nothing else
comes up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dead Man's Shoes.
Never heard of it.
Starring Paddy Considine, directed by Shane Meadows. Revenge thriller.
Oh, yeah.
The Godfather.
Great film. One of the good ones.
And Jaws.
I like that film more than you, I think. I don't love it. I wish there was more time in the town. I want to find out more about that town. It annoys me that they spent... I've talked about this before. It annoys me that they're on the boat for so long.
You should read the book.
Okay.
The book is mostly about stuff going on in the town. This review is, there's only so many day for night shots I can take in my low budget horror films. 5-star. You were never really here. I've logged it 3 times.
1 star better than I Didn't Come Here to Die.
Yes.
30% better. 50% better, I guess.
Okay, this person's name is Gnarly Nut. Their top 4 films are No Country for Old Men.
Good. It's a good one.
Great film. B-movie.
Uh-huh. Very funny.
Star Wars, the first one.
Love it.
We run into it all the time in these top 4 films.
Yeah, it's a good film.
And Akira.
Good film. Tetsuo in Canada.
Yeah.
I love that. It's a long time since I've seen it, but I remember that.
Taken, but with less dialogue and better lighting.
It's funny, you said in the wrong... Did you say that about You Were Never Really Here? In the wrong hands, it would be like...
Taken.
Oh, you were talking about the soundtrack, that's right. Johnny Greenwood, what a genius.
Hour and a half is the perfect film length.
I think Joaquin Phoenix would make a good Fidel Castro in a biopic.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got some time to do it as well. He could, like, as he ages. It's the beard. He has a big beard in this film.
And a half star?
Yeah. How could you? I'm fascinated. That's the mentality I'm fascinated by.
Oh, wow. This person has an incredible top four films. Ridley Scott's The Martian.
Oh, yeah. Haven't seen it.
Rated a comedy by the Golden Globes.
That's so funny to me. Matt Damon.
Train to Busan. The zombie film. Zombies,
right? Yeah.
The Invisible Guest. Never heard of it. A 2016 Spanish language thriller. Dark Waters, directed by Todd Haynes.
Oh, yeah. I should... What, is that the Mark Ruffalo one?
Yeah, it's really good. Really, see that. Really sadly ignored by critics, but a great film, I think.
Have you seen the Zack Snyder... Speaking of zombie films, the Zack Snyder...
Army of the Dead. Yeah. No, I think I might like it.
People seem to.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to try and check that out.
You should.
I'll watch that. I'll watch it tonight.
Okay. And along with... Watch. I Didn't Come Here to Die.
Oh, I'm definitely watching I Didn't Come Here to Die. This review... I've seen hundreds of films. This is the one that was most memorable for how painstakingly boring it was. Any tension fails to build up to anything meaningful, and character development is lacking throughout. If there's one thing this film makes clear, it's that Joaquin Phoenix can't spin gold from straw.
Fascinating. I am fascinated by the kind of person who finds this movie boring. I find it so riveting. Like, it is... I'm just... tense the whole time.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. What,
it is just what different, do we say like, about a different experience. This? It's alien to me.
Yeah.
Like, I could understand someone saying, like... Well, yeah, like, I don't like its vision of the world. It's too fragmented. Like, even, like, it's not enough of a thriller or something. But it's not boring. It's just not... It's just a different... I don't understand.
No, I don't understand at all.
I believe we seem likely to be returning to Brad Pitt next time.
With Inglourious Basterds.
That's right. Which I saw in the cinema and didn't mind, I think.
I like Inglourious Basterds. I like it quite a lot. It's going to be a fun, interesting film to talk about.
Particularly interesting because it has a kind of... It harks back to our decision to do the Brad Pitt cast. Because we did so while waiting to watch a Tarantino film with Brad Pitt in it.
Yeah,
so exactly. We're kind of seeing the beginnings of that relationship.
Oh, how fun. Mm. Tarantino and Pitt.
Although I guess we've already had...
True Romance, written by Tarantino.
Yeah, so there's some...
There's some overlap.
Very vague, but yeah.
Oh, that's going to be a good episode. We get to wrangle with Tarantino.
Yeah. Ugh, boring. Two guys on a podcast talking about Quentin Tarantino. That's what we've been reduced to.
Next time.
Follow us on Twitter, at Brad Pittcast. Email us on email at thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
And we'll see you next time.
See you then. Bye.
Bye. Hello, Joseph here, without Dan. Dan went home a couple of hours ago, and as soon as he went, I knew that there was one thing that I had to do to make this a complete episode. I absolutely had to set it up on my big TV and watch I Didn't Come Here to Die, which I have just finished. It's a tight 80-minute movie. I'm going to give you my professional review, but first, I want to play you some of the craziest things about I Didn't Come Here to Die, which is that it starts in total silence. The credits play over total silence, and then the first sequence, which is shot presumably on digital, but made to look like it's Super 8 film, is scored by nothing but the sound of a police detective and his clothes jangling. I just want to play you some of that clothes jangling, because this goes for, no joke, 3 minutes with nothing else playing, and is the craziest way that I've ever heard a movie open. Let me play you a little bit. That's the sound of a guy just, like, walking about. I don't know if he has a number of large pans attached to his body. I have no idea why he sounds like that, but that's how he sounds. And that's what I Didn't Come Here to Die is like. Creaky and somewhat amateurish in some ways, but extremely fun in all of the ways that it is strange and distinct and low budget. I would almost recommend it. If you have Tubi and you have 80 minutes and you don't know what else to do with your life, then you could spend your one existence on the mortal planes in many worse ways than watching
I didn't come here to die. So, sans Dan, this is just me, but I didn't come here to die. Thumbs up. Thanks, Tubi, for now fucking sponsor us.